I see we've got media people in here. You are all welcome. People from the Reserve Bank, it is always an honor to have you in our midst. Even if you're not going to announce any interest rate cuts or increases and so on and so forth, but your report is always very, very enlightening for us as the honorable members and the public. So let me take this opportunity to welcome you officially. We are here to receive your 2011 annual economic report. And we will be in your hands for the better part of the presentation, and we'll take it from there. I will not take the risk of trying to introduce you to the honorable members. I believe I'll be in perfect order to allow you to do that, and of course to indicate who's going to lead in the presentation. You can see we've got almost a full committee members here present. Thank you.
Honorable Chair Mohammadin and honorable members, let me take this opportunity to introduce the team from the Reserve Bank. My name is Hlengani Mathebula. I'm the head of strategy and communication. I am joined by Vukan Mamba, who is the head of financial analysis and public finance. The gentleman who leads this presentation is Dr. Johan van der Heerfer, who is the senior deputy chief economist and deputy head of the Department of Research. So I will hand over to Johan to lead us on the presentation.
Honorable Chair, members of the committee, I believe that copies have been made available already of both the reports mentioned in the heading over there to the members of the committee. So what we will attempt between Vukani and myself today is really just to highlight a few key features, mainly concentrating on the annual economic report. And we hope then also to be able to answer questions towards the end. All in all, the past year has not been a very bright year in the history of the world economy, and quite a few things have been far too exciting. Nevertheless, we wish to highlight one of the important factors which has been a joker in the pack during this period, namely the oil price. As you will recall from 2008, that caused inflation to drift higher, causing also economic policies to be tightened at the time. There was a big fall in the oil price, but subsequently it has really moved up again very briskly, and so the past year has been one of an increasing set of energy prices, also food prices and many other international prices crept higher, feeding into the inflation spiral and, in a way, taking purchasing power away from consumers. And that did have an impact on the global cycle. A further really important factor, which I'm sure the committee members need not be reminded of, is the increases in the interest risk perceived on bonds issued by a number of peripheral European countries, not least Greece, where, of course, the concerns have been elevated quite a bit for good reason, given their very high government debt levels. And so one can see the spread of interest rates on Greek government bonds versus that, for instance, of German government bonds, as depicted in this particular graph. So that has really cast a cloud on economic advancement in Europe, which has been also one of our major export destinations, and so this also had quite important implications for South Africa, and unfortunately to the downside. As far as the South African business cycle is concerned, not unexpectedly, it continued to be very much aligned with that of the foreign important trading partner countries. For the G7 countries, for instance, one would see that our business cycle very much coincided with theirs during this period, as is very often the case, of course, since our export destinations pull up our economy to some extent, and if things are clouded over there, then things are also very often clouded over here. Well, members might recall from the quarterly bulletin material, there was a small article in there which dated the turning point in the business cycle. So that's one of the technical things which the Reserve Bank does on a frequent basis, to date turning points in the business cycle. We do that with a fairly elaborate process, and the bottom line finding is that the turning point in the business cycle for South Africa was in August 2009. That was the bottom of the cycle, and so since September 2009 we have been experiencing an upswing in the business cycle. Then I think since there's so much interest in the employment aspect of South African society, it is good to report at least that employment, which is the red line on this graph, actually turned around most recently and has been moving slowly upwards, far too little of course and far too slow, but at least the turning point has been reached, and this is customarily the case. First the GDP turns around and then employment tends to follow. And usually GDP has to grow much more quickly before employment really starts to increase quite seriously. So you would remember that the unemployment rate is really on the high side, very high side, and 25.7% being the most recent reading. But moving back to the quarterly numbers which we have, during the first quarter of this year, for which we have hard numbers available, the general government consumption expenditure actually increased quite a bit. There were some military purchases included in that, but also the more underlying government expenditure depicted by the solid line on that graph also moved up slightly. Gross fixed capital formation, capital expenditure in other words, that also increased a bit more forcefully in the first quarter of this year. It actually has been increasing now for four quarters in a row. And then household consumption expenditure, over the past seven quarters, that has been growing, and it has been growing quite solidly, and that has actually been the backbone of the South African upswing so far. So there has been quite a sustained and strong improvement in household consumption expenditure. That is no sin, and it has been increasing nicely. What's also important here is that that increase has been aligned with real disposable income. In other words, people were not spending on credit in a way their incomes went higher, and from that rising income they spent more. So for those reasons, the consumption expenditure did not result in a higher indebtedness ratio, and actually the blue line on this graph shows that the household debt level relative to annual income edged lower, and it is now something like 76.8% of 1 year's income, which is, well, of course, still a very high level, but at least it has been trending slowly lower over the past year or two. Then quite importantly, from the point of view of how much pressure households feel in their finances, the red line is the important one to watch, and over there you would see that it has declined quite a bit. So the debt level has come down a little bit relative to income, but the interest payments on that debt has really come down quite a bit because of the lower interest rate environment. Interest rates have really come down quite a bit, and so most recently the average household would be paying something like 6.9% of their income towards servicing interest on their debt, which is not an extraordinarily high burden. And compared to these previous high values, which you would observe around 2008 and 1998, our current level of debt service cost is really very tame. And that gives some room for households to continue to spend, which I think will continue to support the upswing in the domestic economy. Then, of course, as domestic expenditure picks up, people buy more in the shops, and that is also translated into more television sets being imported, more motor vehicle components, more things across a whole range of imported products. And so one observes again in this graph the increase in the volume of merchandise imports. I think what has, however, been a concern recently is that the South African exports as such have not kept pace with many other things in the global economy. The red line on this graph shows the exports of the emerging market economies, such as China, India, BRIC, and the like. That's been going up quite nicely, as you can see, and they are way above the levels which were recorded at the previous peak in 2008. As for the advanced economies, that's the blue line on the graph, also their exports have been rising. They're not quite back to exactly the level where they were in 2008, but going strongly. But the South African volume of exports, which is the golden line on this graph, has really been quite slow. And that has been a concern, I think, to economists generally. And it is one of the things which I think the South African economy needs to shape up on. So there are a number of reasons for this weakness. Actually, there's quite a long list, but that would include infrastructure bottlenecks, the lack of availability of ample electricity, the pricing thereof, the real exchange rate being on the strong side, which makes life more difficult for exporters. The fact that some of our really important exports, like gold, lies deeper and deeper, and the grades are lower and lower, and there are many problems of deep mining, which makes the volume of that unlikely to go up, even though the price is very, very juicy. And so there are quite a number of impediments to exporting more, some of which I believe are being addressed, but it does take time to address. Well, on the other hand, the export prices have been very helpful. So while our export volumes have not been rising that much, our export values went up a lot because of juicy prices for some commodities at least. So energy commodities, platinum, gold as a hedge in this troubled time, the prices have gone up nicely, and so our export values actually went up quite nicely, and that contributed to the balance on current account narrowing quite a bit. The deficit actually went to more than 7% of GDP previously. Currently it's closer to 3% of GDP, which of course is not unexpected given that the economy is not really strong as yet. The imports really usually gather momentum when the economy has been going up for quite some time and the investment cycle becomes very strong. So we still look forward to that. At that point in time, of course, one would expect imports to rise further and the deficit perhaps to widen a bit more. Then I think it's of some importance to mention that during this whole episode, the South African Reserve Bank has been increasing its holdings of foreign currency quite a bit. So we've been purchasing dollars in the market to a considerable extent, and the red line on this graph shows that. So we've actually moved up on our foreign currency reserve holdings to now more than $50 billion. Not long ago, in 2001, 2002, those values used to be about $8 billion. So there's really been a huge increase. That increase in reserve holdings, however, actually caused us to have to sterilize, because when we buy the dollar, we put rand currency into the market. And if you flood the market with rand liquidity, that upsets the financial markets and this kind of money printing, which is not appropriate. So in some way, the rand which is created in that process must be destroyed again. And there are a number of mechanisms used towards that. The one is with the aid of government. Government has stepped up its deposits with the South African Reserve Bank. That's the light blue area on this graph. Stepped up its deposits quite a bit. Then the Reserve Bank issued its own debentures into the market, its little IOUs, where the Reserve Bank actually sells an IOU typically to a bank, and by doing so they have to give rand back to the Reserve Bank, which then destroys that rand liquidity again. And the other instrument used, another type of IOU almost, the South African Reserve Bank reverse repurchase agreements. So in all of those instances it helped to take out the liquidity created by the increase in our gold and foreign currency reserves. However, despite all of this foreign currency being purchased by the Reserve Bank, in this very wonderful and liquid foreign currency market, that was not sufficient to actually lead to a depreciation of the South African rand. Our exchange rate, which is the green line there, and stronger rand is up on this graph, the exchange rate currently is actually still stronger than where it was at the beginning of 2010, despite all of those purchases of foreign currency. And part of the reason for that is that our export commodity prices like gold and platinum have been very buoyant, which of course supported our export proceeds and in that way underpinned the exchange value of the rand. Well, of course, a strong rand is not good news generally for exporters in manufacturing, but at least it is helpful from the inflation point of view. And so with generally sustainable monetary and fiscal policies and with a strengthening exchange rate, the inflation rate has actually declined quite a bit, and we currently have inflation rates which are close to the midpoint of the range. If you strip out the volatile components like food and energy, you still find that the inflation rate is quite tame, really on the tame side, which I think is good from an inflation monitoring point of view in an inflation targeting country like South Africa. I think with those remarks, more on the domestic real economy and balance of payments and prices side, I would then love to hand over to my colleague Vukani Mamba, who will look at the financial aspects and also some long-term impressions of the South African Reserve Bank.
Thank you, Chair and Committee. I then take you through the more financial developments in the economy over the past years. In fact, the Reserve Bank did celebrate its 90th anniversary of its founding. So we tried to give a picture, a longer picture of what we have seen out of the South African economy, to try and commemorate this long period of the bank's existence. As Johan has already shown this picture on moderating domestic inflation, this moderation in inflation then allowed space for the policy rates to be aggressively reduced as we Yes, the graph to the left is the one where we try to show what happened when our economy or many other economies were confronted with the Southeast Asian crisis in 1998, where we had a spike in our inflation, as shown by the red line. at the bottom left of the graph, which was then followed by some monetary policy tightening. The repo rate went up. It went up into the lower 20s, which was extremely high, and if we were to show growth in that period, well, it was also somewhat disturbed by the high inflation and high interest rates. In the graph on the left-hand side, we show the recent crisis, which started off as a global financial crisis out of the U.S. and spread all over the globe. The inflation, as the red line shows, did pick up quite strongly. And of course, that was at the back of higher commodity prices, which would include your oil and food in that period. And of course, we hiked interest rate in that period. But as we were trying to contain inflation in that late half of 2008, we then ran into the global financial crisis, which then saw economic performance, generally output and spending decline. And we then began to lower our policy interest rates, which is the repurchase rate. And we did it very aggressively all the way to the middle of 2009. Inflation continued to decline, and further consideration for reducing rates were taken. We ended up in late 2010 with our repurchase rate standing at the lowest rate in 30 years. But then inflation in early 2011 has started to pick up, as Johan has spoken, to the point of higher commodity prices leading to higher fuel in the main and some food inflation. We have resisted so far, or the policy board committee has not yet thought it prudent to raise the repo rate. It still remains at 5.5%. Even though inflation has picked up quite substantially in the period. The main consideration on keeping the repo rate unchanged in the face of rising inflation has probably been the story of growth that has continued not to be strong on the supply side or the production side of the economy. So most of the recovery, as Johan has shown, has been on the spending side. He has described the elements of the spending quite elaborately. Whilst there has been moderation in inflation and our interest rates being at a 30-year low, these low interest rates have not stimulated lending by banks sufficiently. As you can see, the red line, which is right at the bottom here, basically what we are trying to show you here are several recessionary periods. And these periods are always coincide with a sustained drop in credit extension by the banking sector. But the recovery of the different recessionary phases seem to be different from one to the other. We see the top blue one, which was the 1982 one. It was sharp falling, but it recovered quite quickly. That is a credit extension by the banking sector. While the one that we are facing now, which is the red line, has been the deepest decline in credit extension. And it has recovered, but the recovery has not been convincing. We explain the phenomena on two sides of the economy. The demand for credit has been impaired by the fact that our household debt levels are still very high, as you saw in the earlier graph shown by Johan. Therefore, people are not clean enough to present themselves successfully to lenders and obtain credit. We also note that the earlier graph showed some deep job losses. Therefore, people have fallen off the employment pedestal and therefore unable to come forward and borrow. We also do show, I don't remember if we did show it, but it is a common fact that production has not recovered sufficiently in the post-recovery phase. Therefore, the South African economy still has sufficient excess or surplus production capacity. That would therefore mean that companies are not demanding credit to finance their production needs, i.e. pay wages and electricity and buy inputs and all of that. So there is excess capacity on the production side of the economy, and therefore restraining the appetite for credit from the corporate sector. So we have those three things that we cite on the demand side, i.e. high debt levels for households, a weak job market, and surplus capacity on the production side. On the supply side, we note that banks did incur some higher than usual non-performing loans on their books, and that requires them to do some repair work on their balance sheets. And of course, this is in the view of, I'm sure you, Honourable House here, were instrumental in enacting for us the National Credit Act, which now banks have to keep looking at what the Act says about their conduct in lending. So they really and truly do scrutinize those who come forward to borrow. And they are the borrower or potential borrower's ability to repay a loan is paramount in the minds of bankers. So those will be the compelling reasons for the prudency on the banking sector side in lending, which is protecting the economy in the main, because we saw that the financial crisis in the U.S. was triggered by excessive lending to people who didn't have strong incomes to sustain higher interest rates. We then go forward to house prices. We put a lot of emphasis to this graph for the reason that when house prices are strong, some consumers are able to remortgage their properties and access extra credit from the banking institution. But that only happens when the house prices are strong and robust, as in the period that is shown by 2006 earlier on. When they do borrow from using their houses as collateral, of course those houses with higher prices will give them a little more out of the banking sector. Then they do go out and finance consumption and fuel expenditure in the economy. So we do pay attention to this graph for that reason. In the recession, it collapsed in early 2009, the house prices, they recovered very strongly, but that recovery lost momentum by the beginning or the middle of the second half, or the middle of 2010. We were apprehensive in the sense that we were suspecting a double dip in early 2011 in house prices, but somewhere towards the middle of 2011, there seemed to be some recovery in house prices. But we do not know whether this recovery can sustain higher interest rates were the bank to resume increasing rates. another support for spending normally do come from healthy share prices, where when share prices go up, some of the shareholders do sell their shares and finance consumption. So we also do place emphasis on what is happening on, in this asset class. We saw a runaway in commodity prices in the period 2006 to 2008, and that was beneficial by most measures. Households benefited from, those who are shareholders benefited from that boom in the commodity price boom. Companies that are linked to the resources sector also benefited. The government also, with the profitability of all these sectors that we show here, also benefited with elevated collections of revenue. But all that collapsed at the height of the recession. But quickly there was some recovery, though that recovery is starting to lose momentum, as you have seen on your televisions and radio stations in the past few weeks. Then we show you the fiscal position of the government, which, as I have already outlined, did benefit from the robust commodity prices and general profitability of companies in the period preceding the crisis. We know that the minister does come here and present his budget to the House. You have seen the story where where finances were managed such that when there is plenty, there is a compelling reason to put aside some of the revenue and not use all of it when the sun shines, because we know that sunshine is always followed by rain. And indeed, then when the crisis hit the South African economy, there was fiscal space, that's what the Treasury people will call it, to be able to use those surplus funds that they put aside when the sunny days were with us, and then now to use those funds to support spending. When that line goes down, it is a time when government is spending more to support the economy, and indeed that was done. We were then looking ahead to say, when you see the dotted line, that as the economy recovers, the government will start to reduce its deficits going forward as the economy improves. But the improvement is starting or being seen becoming more robust closer to 2013 and 2014 fiscal year. In the good years, again here, we see some measured or small surpluses on the broader public sector and, of course, the general government. The consolidated general government, which is all the levels of government, is the dark blue bars, and the non-financial public enterprises and corporations is the orangish line. They all managed their finances quite prudently in the boom years, but we have seen them now borrowing more post the crisis to support the economic activity in the main by the national government. But the public enterprises are borrowing increasingly more to fund their infrastructure requirements. The story of Eskom is known to this committee, where there are huge funding requirements going forward. And of course, the government, as we have shown, is or has taken measures to support the economy in the crisis period. There are some snapshots on the longer term history of celebration of the South, where we start off by showing you the real gross domestic product all the way from 1921 around the formation of the bank. There it starts off with the recession, which is associated with the World War I. But post World War I, there was some robust recovery, which then was interrupted by the onset of the Great Depression, which started in 1929 going to 1933. But once those problems were sorted out by the creation of the International Monetary Fund in the mid-40s, and the World Bank, funding started to flow again, and a big boom ensued from that point onwards. Generally, the 60s into the 70s were years of robust growth for the South African economy, but we saw that beginning to falter in the early 80s. That would be expected as some coming out of the first oil price shock, at least that I've seen in my life, in 1979. That gave the world inflation, including South Africa, and it became a very volatile period, and with very high interest rates around that time, and the high interest rates demonstrating or showing the scarcity of money around that time. And that was a period of high volatility, the 80s and all the way to the end of the 80s. In early 1990, there was a recession, largely in the sub-region. It was compounded by some drought conditions and also some uncertainty in the economy coming out of the broader political environment. That recovery is taking off then in 1994 going forward, with some disturbance in 1998, as I've indicated earlier on, with the Southeast Asian crisis. But post that period, then we went into some serious improved growth, not only in South Africa, but also globally, up until the early 2009 recession. Production structure of the South African economy has changed in major ways, where in the 20s, agriculture was a big contributor, somewhere near 20% to GDP, but that contribution from the agricultural sector has been continuously shrinking. It may not be necessarily the level of output in agriculture that was shrinking, but it is the share of agriculture in total economic growth, because the other sectors became a little more important. And as you can see at the top, the services sector has been increasing all the way to the latest 2010 picture there. The financial sector also became prominent in the last 3 years, and manufacturing did pick up from the 50s and became a major contributor in the South African economy, while mining has fluctuated but generally in a downward direction, largely because of the complications of mining gold out of deeper mines in our country. Inflation, you have a very long period of post-World War I recession, or that's where recessions are generally associated with deflation, where inflation becomes or is measured and come out negative or showing negative growth. As the economy recovered into the 60s, inflation did pick up, but it was relatively restrained in the highest growth period of the 60s and the 70s. But it does pick up substantially, as I had said, around the period of the first oil crisis of 1979. Which was repeated again in 1974. There was another oil crisis. So that has been inflationary. It would therefore seem that oil prices have brought or have visited most economies or the global economy with serious inflation. And hence we have seen also recently that the high commodity prices and oil prices has resulted in higher consumption and consumer inflation. The lower inflation makes it possible for most central banks, including ours, to maintain low interest rates. And of course, the periods which I've spoken to of high oil prices, high inflation, led to higher interest rates to try and rein in the higher inflation. But as inflation subsides, lower interest rates get to the same. Chair, let us conclude by saying that the high international commodity prices and sovereign debt, of course, is government, the debt of government, are a concern in the global economy as we speak today. And we have seen a recent consumer-led upswing in the South African economy. We hope that it will inspire some confidence for production to be stimulated on the other hand, which we hope will therefore be a panacea for our high unemployment. Unemployment creation is lagging and is lackluster, as we said, but we hope for a stronger recovery in the economy that can create jobs going forward. Inflation contained and interest rates at their lowest level since 1980, although inflation risks are starting to rear an ugly head again through the oil price. I think that will be our story. Chair. The story is very short, but it summarizes the two documents that we have before us. That is the annual economic report and the quarterly bulletin report. Honorable members, I see Honorable Steve Swart, followed by Dr. Luyenge, and Honorable Korenwolf. You'll be followed by Madlamini and Dr. George.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentation. The whole presentation is historical, which we appreciate up to a certain point, annual report and the quarterly report. What is significant for me is on page 6, where you've got your one slide relating to export volumes were slow to respond and the pace of recovery was weaker than that of both emerging market and advanced economies exports. One would have expected that is a bit disappointing. And could you give us a reason for that? Is it related to productivity, competitiveness, and what would you ascribe that to? And then, of course, the million-dollar question, the events of the last few days, whilst it isn't, strictly speaking, part of your presentation, would you comment on what impact the events of the last few days have, the downgrading of the American credit rating resulting in the market drop that we've seen worldwide? Obviously, that is going to have an impact if one of your concerns is sovereign debt crisis in Greece as well. That, together with that slowdown on exports, what impact is that going to have on our export market? What impact will that then have on our GDP growth? And then, of course, what impact will that have on our fiscal policy and your slide relating to the large deficit, where you've got the dotted line, and that's the million-dollar question when we look at fiscal policy. What impact is that going to have on revenues and on our fiscal sustainability? We as a committee have expressed our concerns about our debt levels, and whilst it's not strictly your ambit, but you did refer to that in your slide. Just give us an indication. We obviously, many people are concerned about the events of the last 2 days, and we'd appreciate your comments in that regard. Thank you very much.
Chair, should we respond immediately, or?
No. Few of the questions, just no other questions. Honourable Luyange.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. Let me first wish well the governor of the bank, who Comrade Jill Marcus on her birthday today. Without saying much during this month, it is a positive coincidence that we are here today. Let me pose my question that relates to the panarchical understanding of the past as to what were the fiscal remedial measures that were created to create space to reduce the policy interest rate to aggressively support the domestic economic recovery. I'm asking this question, Chairperson, because there are global tendencies by institutions like government that seek to ensure that there is sustainability and sustenance of the economy of a country. Now, in comparing our country with the global reality that says the economic downturn does not necessarily affect us alone, but we are doing well as against other countries, then can we look back and check as to what were the tendencies in the past? Yeah, that's my question, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Can I just, I think as a central banker, you will probably agree that if you have an option, you will go for a non-volatile currency market. And that is important, I think, to have that. But we have seen in the 48 hours, you know, that the rand plummeted, you know, quite severely, the largest plummet in 18 months. And what I want to ask is, I don't know what is all the reasons for that, but one that was mentioned is that people were seeing the rand as a risky investment and therefore taking out their money. Now, I just want your comments on that, whether you are concerned that we are being seen as a risky environment when foreign markets are in jeopardy.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to the presentation from the Reserve Bank. My first contribution is on page 3, where you look at the output vis-a-vis the employment. Unfortunately, the slide goes up to 2010, so my first question will be, where are we now? Is the picture still the same? Because it doesn't go to 2011 as we are looking at the quarterly reports for 2011. Maybe it's a mistake or an error there. Then the other question is, if you look at that slide, you look at the employment, which you get yourself a hope that there is an improvement, but at the same time you ask yourself a question that which says that you look at the domestic product, sitting right there, which is right on top, and you look at the improvement, then you ask yourself, which contributors in the sector that has actually gave this change of improving the employment? And if it's about the domestic products, they were coming from which sector? Was it from manufacturing? Was it from where exactly were they coming from? And the improvement of the employment that we are seeing on this graph, that's what I'm saying, it's for 2010, I don't know whether it's the same picture now, was it coming from was it relevant to the sector, to the domestic product that we're talking about, if it's manufacturing or from somewhere, or bits and pieces from all the sectors? That's the first question. And then the next question goes to the page 8, which talks about the policy rate inflation crisis period. You know, I heard that the first presentation, when we're looking at the first quarterly report, not on the financial development, it was actually, I think there was a report which says that our repurchase increased. You correct me if I'm wrong. It increased, I don't know whether to 50 something million dollars in 2011. But if I look at the slide there, I am saying 2011, and you compare with 29, late 2009, does it translate to that repurchasing that you talk about earlier on? If so, why did you do so much repurchase? Was there a need to do that? Because looking at this financial crisis, it means globally there was a crisis, but we go all the way out to go and repurchase, and we repurchase so much. We actually increase, and the reason why? Why did you do that? The last one here is on page 10, the government fiscal balances. I can see that those are the projections which say that by 2013-2014, government fiscal may become robust. What factors did you use that has landed you into that decision? How tangible, reachable are they? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you to the Reserve Bank for your presentation, a very informative and thorough analysis. It is disappointing that the governor is not here today, because a great deal has happened in the global economy over the past few days. It will have a significant impact on our economy going forward. I wanted to ask the Governor whether calls for nationalisation are adding to uncertainty over our economic prospects at a time when stability is the most important element needed to prevent an economic meltdown. But I will not ask the delegation from the South African Reserve Bank to comment on that today, but I will ask your views about the current turmoil in the international economy. How is it going to impact on us in your view? And specifically, how is the bank responding to this new crisis? And what have you done to look at the potential impact? Are we going to see a slide in our GDP growth, which will impact on our tax revenues and on the welfare of our people? Thank you, Chairperson.
You can respond. Oh, sorry. There is Mr. Honorable Mare, I have to forget his name, and he knows why. Honorable Mare.
Thank you very much, Chair, for at least acknowledging me. I really appreciate that. I feel very special. Thank you very much. Thank you for the presentation. It was excellent and very informative as well. If I go to the slides about the export volumes, there are the one slide that is enormously concerning, comparing our exports to advanced economies and also emerging economies, and it seems like we are lagging behind extremely far. The next slide indicates a favorable trend in terms of narrowing the current account deficit. Now, it's difficult to marry these two. On the one side, you show a very poor performance in terms of exports comparing to the rest of the world, and then you're indicating a narrowing of that gap. What is the contributors to that narrowing of the gap? Is it predominantly commodities? Because if it is commodities and commodity exports, it's again indicating to, yes, there are exports, and we're making use of the value of that. But does that create jobs? Does that add to local beneficiation? Is it manufacturing sector where we need, which we know is a priority of government? If it is not, then obviously there's some failure in this process, and it means that some policy is not delivering the goods that was initially intended. The next question is the next slide, the very next slide, where it indicates an increase in government deposits with the Reserve Bank. Now, can you indicate to me the source of that deposits? Is it purely a shift of government deposits from commercial banks to the Reserve Bank? Or is it maybe unspent money? In other words, where does this come from? And what was the purpose of this money initially? I just want to make sure that it's not money that was intended to stimulate economy and job creation activities, and now it's unspent, and now it lies as deposits with the Reserve Bank. Can you just clarify that for me, please? And then the last question is your slide on mortgage loans. Now, for me, that position also seems to be correlating with the implementation of the National Credit Act. What one hears so often these days from consumers is that banks don't want to lend money because of the restrictions of the National Credit Act. Now, to what extent is it banks, or to what extent is it this mechanism that government has brought in called the National Credit Act, and is there unintended consequences of that? And to what extent must that be put under the, what do you call the vergrootglas in English, the magnifying glass? Thank you very much. Thank you.
We've got a whole host of questions. We hope we'll be able to track them down and give us adequate responses.
Thank you, Chair. Let me start then, firstly, with a question on the export performance, which has been unfortunately relatively weak on the volume side. And that's then within the global context, which we currently have. And I think that also touches on a later question, which boils down to the same problem which we've had. The reasons for the weakness in our export volumes is actually not singular. It's quite a number of things which happened at the same time and which have been impeding the volume of our exports. To pin it down to just the exchange rate would definitely be wrong. But the strength of the exchange rate has created less of an incentive for exporters to run into new markets and to up their volumes. So that has been one of the things. Productivity in general has been a problem. We are competing against other countries such as China, where productivity increases are really quite dramatic, and in that process it is difficult to enter into new export markets and capture them. But it does not help, of course, if you are simply constrained from the supply side
by our export infrastructure capacity. And that has then been an unfortunate element of our dispensation, where our ability to export and take advantage of nice commodity prices has been impaired by simply the capacity of our transport infrastructure to export a greater volume of things. So that's been quite an important impediment. Fortunately, as members of the committee would know, our government is actually, through the parastatals and through government itself, addressing some of these infrastructure bottlenecks. But as things go, to change infrastructure takes long. The planning of a pipeline, the expansion of a harbour, that's things which unfortunately take a lot of time. As members would know, in the fiscal plans which are presented by the Treasury from time to time, it includes projections by parastatals on how much capital expenditure they will also undertake, and quite a lot is underway. But it has unfortunately been a factor impeding progress in this area. The electricity concerns, again, I think while we have fortunately not seen the electricity bottleneck come to the fore in this year in terms of us running out of capacity during the winter time, and while we also know that big projects are currently taking very nice shape, for the moment one would assume that exporters are a bit reluctant to commit big expenditures, capital expenditures, to up their export capacity just at a time when there is still not delivered electricity capacity on the ground installed already. So that is to some extent still a friction. And then I think we should really not underestimate the importance of just our natural mix of export partners. Over the years, we have been exporting a lot to Europe, not so much to China, not so much to some of the other emerging countries, and it's exactly in Europe where the weakness in economic activity has been most severe post-crisis. So because of that, we actually have to redirect our export destinations and capture new export markets, which is a very difficult process, and that takes a lot of time too. So for all of these reasons, unfortunately, our export volumes have not been magnificent. But I think I can, at the same time, perhaps refer to the problem of our export volumes being so weak, but nevertheless our deficit on the current account being much smaller than before. And the reason of that is twofold. The one is that our export prices have been very juicy. There's been really a marvelous run up in the prices of coal, of platinum, of gold. The gold has really benefited quite nicely from the uncertainty in the global environment. So uncertainty is not necessarily just to the downside of South African producers. It depends on where you are in the economy. And so all of that has actually increased export proceeds in nominal terms. The rand value accruing to South Africa has actually been rising quite nicely because of better prices, not so much because of better volumes, although the volumes are also increasing, but not as quickly as one would love to see. And then the second reason for our deficit on current account being smaller is that imports have been much lower. As members would recall, our magnitude of fixed capital formation, capital expenditure, in volume terms has fallen quite a lot post-crisis. So during times when the economy is weak, firms don't invest that much, they don't expand. It's only when their production again starts knocking on the productive capacity ceiling that they really start investing big time. That point has not been reached. So our imports of capital goods has not been that much. Even our imports of consumer goods, while it has risen quite a bit again, is not where it previously stood. And so it's on the import volume side where we have had a reprieve, and then on the export prices side where we have had a reprieve, and for those reasons then the balance on current account, the deficit on current account has narrowed quite nicely, and we are happy for that. Well, for fiscal policy, of course, if our export performance continues to be weak, that has implications. We would not be having as much of an income injected into the South African economy, and the proceeds from that, therefore the fiscus would be reduced accordingly. And for those reasons, it's very necessary, I think, that South Africa does its utmost to increase our export capacity also in volume terms. The global context is currently, well, to say the least, mildly uncertain, and that does not also probably give the best of circumstances for expanding our production just based on known foreign demand. I think I will ask my colleague Fukani Mamba to speak a bit about the fiscal remedial measures which have allowed interest rates to be lowered as it has, and about the fiscal situation in general. So, but we can perhaps defer that to a few minutes later. And let me in the meantime move on to the volatility of the exchange rate. Yes, very rightly, the option which central bankers would always prefer is a more orderly and gradual movement of the exchange rate rather than very jumpy exchange rate. The reasons remain unclear. We just know that in the foreign currency markets things will continue to jump up and down quite a bit. But at least there are some risk management things which central banks and fiscal authorities can do to instill more confidence and to reduce volatility in that market. What we have done in South Africa is to build up our foreign currency reserve position quite a bit. So as I indicated previously, in the early 2000s, we had foreign currency reserve levels of something like $8 billion or thereabout. Currently, we have about $50 billion or thereabout, which is really quite an increase. And that gives some confidence. Now, there's enough money in the kitty so that if our import-export balance really goes in the wrong direction, we can continue paying for imports happily, and there is some reassurance coming from that. So generally that is a good sign. We have also gotten rid of the oversold forward position in foreign currency, the so-called forward book of the Reserve Bank. We've actually reversed it so that we now have forward dollars coming in future rather than forward dollars going out in future. So I think that has also been quite helpful in instilling more confidence. And more generally, I think by demonstrating sustainable fiscal and monetary policies, our authorities have given an general guidance pointers that policy will be sound and that investors should not look at us as a risky destination. But to go to one of the later questions, it seems that foreign investors, when things are uncertain, sometimes they just prefer the familiar. The American investor, when things are very difficult, quite often prefers simply to pull back money into the USA, where they know it is their government that is overseeing the financial system, and where in a certain way they feel more comfortable that their money is under their own national control rather than being put in another country's banking system or financial system. So for that reason, in 2008-2009, when actually the American system was not at all extremely sound and happy, the Americans, for instance, took back money into their destination and in that process caused emerging market countries' exchange rates to fall quite a bit, as we also experienced. So to some extent the same thing may happen, but it will reverse again. But there are these bouts in which investors, international investors, simply become more inward-looking and they pull money back to the known rather than to the unknown and to what they then perceive as the familiar rather than the unfathomable. So I think we see that from time to time. There is no reason to think that these fluctuations will come to an end, of course, but these tend to go in the one direction and into the other. There were some questions about employment and output. And yes, indeed, of course, Subsequent to these graphs being prepared, there have been further information regarding employment released by Statistics South Africa, which we are happy to always follow. And, well, it kind of continued the trend of a slow increase, seasonally adjusted and all that, in the employment numbers. It remains, unfortunately, not enough to make inroads into unemployment and to make for a sparkling set of outcomes. But in the annual economic report, for instance, I think on page 20, there are some numbers tabled which tells the story of what's been happening to employment in the economy, at least in the formal sectors. But the bottom line is that in our recent employment upswing, and right through the time period during which the economy went through really tough times, 2008, 2009, early 2010, during that period it's been the parastatals and government that have been the major employment creators. So that has underpinned the employment which there was, and that was one of the benefits of having had previously strict fiscal policies. As Vukani said, when the times were good, we put money away, and it made it possible for the public sector then to come to the fore during difficult times to create some employment still. As far as the government fiscal balances are concerned and factors that will impact those going forward, and I think there the question is about 2011, 12, 2013, 14, kind of the future trajectory. Well, the assumptions there, I think one could interrogate perhaps rather asking that from the people from the National Treasury when they again present to the committee. But my recollection is that quite rightly there was an assumption that the economy will grow more robustly going forward. So as the economy gathers further momentum, currently we have a consumption-led expenditure upswing that will increasingly become more fixed investment probably. The inventory cycle will also turn around. Government will continue to spend a bit more also. Between all of those expenditure things and from a more healthy supply side, we hope that therefore the growth will pick up, and as the growth picks up, more employment is created, and we already saw in earlier slides that at least that is starting to go upwards rather than downwards, and in that process a number of multipliers then act in order to up income, from which more taxation can be forthcoming. So, however, it's a fairly mild program. Now, it's not as if suddenly we move, according to those projections, from a fiscal deficit to a fiscal surplus or anything like that. The deficit is just contained and starts to narrow quite gradually, which is probably the right way to go during a period of international turmoil and uncertainty, where you would not love to give a sudden signal that we are now tightening dramatically and in that process perhaps killing off the upswing or making it more difficult for the upswing to progress. Okay, as far as the current turmoil is concerned, how does it impact? Well, of course, it's a fairly heavy impact on expectations, business confidence and consumer confidence. It is quite clear that people will be, under the circumstances, more reluctant to enter into bold ventures, big capital expenditures, really kind of heavily geared undertakings. And so that is not good news for short-term growth, probably, and for longer-term investment. Things just might be delayed a bit further. One should recognize that. But that said, a consumer-led upswing, as we currently have, which is not heavily credit-dependent, is a far more sustainable animal. And a consumer-led upswing in an environment of relatively low inflation and generally healthy financial policies inside the country, and also given the assurance of a fairly strong financial system, with good prudential measures in place. For all of those reasons, one would actually expect that, kind of, despite the external circumstances which we import from Europe and from the USA and some other destinations, despite those uncertainties, our domestic upswing will continue and will take us forward, at least in kind of despite the international environment, not because of the international environment. One should also be happy, I think, about the kind of unexpected benefit of higher uncertainty feeding the gold price, which is at least to some extent of a positive impact for the South African economy. What has the bank done about this current turmoil? Well, as I said, we just stick to fairly prudent policies. We have reduced interest rates quite a lot, but for the right reasons. There's a big output gap. We don't see bottleneck inflation rushing ahead. And we actually have created the space, and there is low inflation. The low inflation setting really makes it possible to have lower interest rates and a bit of stimulation through that avenue without risking irresponsibility and promiscuity in monetary policy. So, and then on top of that, while we are supporting the upswing in that way, we have, as I said, gathered a lot of foreign currency reserves. We have really stepped out of foreign currency reserves quite remarkably during this period. Now, that reserve accumulation which we have done, of course, in that one graph which shows the level of reserves, members of the committee might remember that in that graph it's actually the rand values which we show. The idea was to show the rand value of the reserves and in the rand value of the liquidity draining measures which we have put in place. Had one looked not at the rand value of the reserves but at the dollar value, the trend would have been much more unilaterally upward over this period. But in the past 3 years or so, because the rand has been strong and strengthening against the US dollar, for that reason the top line of that graph kind of then moved sideways and even a little bit down. But that's because of revaluation effects. So because the rand is stronger against the dollar, it means that actually then in rand terms, those dollar reserves are worth less for the moment, in rand terms. So yes, thank you, that's the right one. Then the government deposits with the South Africa, well, in terms of our reverse repurchase agreements, that's really just a money market instrument where the Reserve Bank temporarily borrows money, typically from another bank. So it's a short-term borrowing from another bank where they give us rand and we give them a promise to repay the rand a couple of days, weeks or months into the future. And that's in these reserve repurchase agreements. They've been used very lightly, I must say. It's a very small portion of our total intervention in order to get liquidity in the money market to the levels we would love to see it. More importantly has been the Reserve Bank debentures, the dark blue, and then the government deposits with the South African Reserve Bank. As far as those government deposits with the Reserve Bank are concerned, well, it's a bit of a mix where it comes from. To some extent, government did indeed take money which was previously deposited with private sector banks and redeposit it with the Reserve Bank. In that process, then, the private banks have less rand and the Reserve Bank has more rand deposited with it. And in that process now, the private banking sector's stock of rand has been tightened a bit. So, but government, in order to get those build-ups in deposits, of course, they did not actually push down their expenditure below the budgeted plans. Generally, government's outcomes for the overall budget has been to have expenditures fairly well aligned with what was budgeted previously. Yes, there are instances of certain departments and certain functions where there have been under expenditures or over expenditures, but as a whole, government has been fairly good in reaching its expenditure outcomes more or less as was budgeted for. So no, the reason then for the build-up of deposits was not non-expenditure, but government, well, in order to support this accumulation of foreign currency reserves, They really just had to rake in some tax money and issue some government debt instruments in order to be able to build up these deposits. So, I mean, make no mistake, to accumulate reserves costs money. That is why if one wants to influence the exchange rate heavily and lean against the exchange rate, perhaps strengthening too much, that is a costly exercise. Now, in some way, the sterilization thing's cost must be borne, and government contributed to this program of accumulating reserves by building up its deposits with the central bank, and in order to do that, there's now a higher interest cost of government debt instruments, treasury bills and government bonds which have been issued in order to finance this higher level of deposits. So I think that's kind of quite an important thing to note, that foreign currency accumulation does not come for free, and for that reason there are some constraints on what can be done. We were going from $8 billion to $50 billion US dollars is not insignificant. Okay, yes, perhaps I can ask my colleague Vukani then to deal with further fiscal questions and also with the National Credit Act and its restrictions and what came from that.
Thank you, Chair. On the fiscal policy side, maybe we can even attempt to combine it with the monetary policy a little bit. Historically speaking, we started off in the 90s as an economy with very high deficits to our GDP. We also had significant debt measured against our GDP. So the National Treasury, starting off, had a task to normalize the deficits, to normalize the debt from very high levels. So the preoccupation was clear to continuously bring this down to be comparable with economies of our size and profile. So that was done all the way towards 2003-2004. When the Treasury arrived at that point, then it became a little more expansionary in its approach to fiscal policy, to say now that our deficits and debt level have been consolidated substantially, the revenue started to improve, of course, with the global economy picking up around 2004 going forward. That was helpful in getting revenue in. Also, of course, apart from just consolidating or bringing down deficits and debt levels, there were major efforts, which I'm sure parliamentarians of the time were aware of, that the revenue collection efforts were substantially increased. With the revamping of SARS and coming in with the methods of collecting money due to government. So revenue improvements came along, and those were also quite useful in helping government bring down the deficits and debt levels. But it is in the most recent minister's presentation to this committee in February, where he then made profound pronouncements about what has to become of fiscal policy going forward. If I recall, what he said was that we need to look at our fiscal balances or positions with a view that we don't indebt or get the future generations highly indebted. I think that's the point that he made to this committee or parliament. And the second point that he made was that it is generally and broadly helpful for fiscal policy to be counter-cyclical. and also counter-cyclicality is the conduct of monetary policy. The counter-cyclicality basically would mean that when the economy is doing well, revenues coming in, we should, or he would seek to maintain spending that is smooth without peaks and ebbs, so that government spending is made to grow at a predictable rate going forward. I think that and that would mean that when revenue is healthy, he will not get too excited to spend all of it. He will keep some for the rainy days he spoke about. And then when we reach that bumpy patch on our economy, he will then go into that kitty and spend it to maintain stable government spending. So that is the nature of a counter-cyclicality according to the fiscal policy side. Counter-cyclicality also means something else for the Reserve Bank. The Reserve Bank also is interested in counter-cyclicality, which means that when the economy is growing robustly, it tends to create inflation. And when it creates inflation, the Reserve Bank will respond to the inflationary pressures by raising interest rates. And then when the economy reaches a slump, inflation normally follows downwards, you know, with the slump in growth. And when inflation comes down, the Reserve Bank will then stand ready to bring down interest rates and boost the economy. So this is now a conjecture that we think both policy instruments will be following going forward, counter-cyclicality, as we have described it. What other angle am I supposed to address? The National Credit Act. The National Credit Act came in at the height of the upswing in the economy, such that we are now experiencing the first decline in economic activity since the National Credit Act was put into place. We are now waiting to see a new upswing in economic activity. Therefore, we are unable to make concrete judgmental positions about whether the lack of credit extension or the more modest credit extension by banks is a result of the National Credit Act or generally the economic conditions, as I spoke to that story earlier on. We did cite the fact that our households are highly indebted, therefore they cannot carry on to borrow on top of the debts that they have. I think the National Credit Act, which you promulgated, prohibits that. And I think it is also for the health of the banking sector not to overburden its books with people who may become encumbered and able to service their debts at a time when interest rates start to rise. So the banks, we will give them the benefit of the doubt for now and say, we will see when this economy is in full swing, production capacity diminishing, to see whether they will continue not to lend. We are of the opinion that as the economy recovers sufficiently, creates new jobs, creates an opportunity for companies to borrow and fund working capital, we think that the banks are going to come to the party. We don't think it is to their interest not to lend. We think they are in the business of lending, but we hope and pray that they lend responsibly.
Okay. Maybe before I take the next round of questions, I just wanted to refer you to the 90-year snapshots, four snapshots. The first slide, maybe we can put it there.
Yeah, this one. You can see here post-World War recession, 1929 to 1933, the Great Depression. I think the whole world suffered during this period. And the second phase of negative growth, which you've covered in your presentation, is between 1980 and 1994, basically. Somewhere there, 94-95. I do understand the first negative growth in the early 80s, I mean the mid-80s, that you're saying it was a high period of high instability and oil shocks. Of course, sanctions here were also playing a very, very important role at that time to have this kind of a negative shock in the economy. But in between, you've had a positive growth of the South African economy just before another decline, negative growth of the early 90s. What was the propelling force that drove this particular growth at that time? I'll be interested just to know whether it was deficit spending or something else.
Thank you, Chair. That was actually, well, of course, the whole 1980s, because of financial sanctions against South Africa and lots of volatility in international markets and local perceptions, was very, very volatile and very difficult. But so members would probably recall that we had a debt standstill in the mid-1980s because South Africa had run up too much short-term foreign debt commitments. We could not meet all of those commitments at the same time that more severe financial sanctions were imposed against South Africa and uncertainty was elevated. And so that was when we had a debt standstill imposed. There was a big lack of confidence. Investment spending by the private sector actually fell quite a bit and things were very difficult at the time. That put the economy into really severe recessionary conditions around about 1985-86. In response to that, the financial policies were eased quite a bit, both fiscal and monetary policy. Actually, the interest rates went down quite a bit. In 1984, August, we raised the repo rate, or its precursor, the bank rate, quite a bit, which led to the prime rate, the prime lending rate of the banks, going to 25%, which was very, that was quite something at the time. It was really whacking the economy on the head. That was 1984. The fiscal policies also made a roundabout from expansionary to very tight, and then the economy went into this big fall. In order then to start upping the economy again, the interest rates were reduced quite quickly, and actually the prime lending rate went from 25% to something like 12% within 2 years. So it kind of halved in more or less 2 years in order to try and get some new life into the patient. At the same time, the fiscal policy also eased a bit, and between that, it helped the economy again to move up a bit. I think at the same time, the exchange rate was somewhat lower, and generally, the world economy, that's quite important, the world economy was doing okay in the late 1980s. So we were at least dealing with world markets, although they were imposing sanctions on South Africa for political reasons, where the underlying incomes and appetite were increasing. So for all of those reasons, and remember coming from a low base, we had those 3 years of quite nice positive growth, but very rapidly we then got again into a situation where our imports, because of the growth, went up quite a bit. And because of financial sanctions, could not access international borrowing any further, we had to curtail that upswing after 3 years with, again, fairly heavy policies. Again, so the Monetary policy was tightened again in 1989 quite a bit. Fiscal policy also had to become a bit more restrictive during that time, and that's when we had these negative growth rates. Those negative growth rates, however, also coincided with bringing inflation down to single digits in the early 1990s.
Yeah, lastly on my side before, I just want to also say, just looking at the presentation, and the fact that we are in a very flux state. This is an annual report that covers 2010, 2011. Of course, in this flux state, what we might have observed in April may not necessarily hold true today because of this shift in sense in the world economy, basically, and we're part of this integrated global market. And therefore, I think to a large extent, I do agree with Dr. George. Not that the team that is here is not capable of handling all the interactions that we want to have. But we think in this crisis situation, this report would have required even the governor to be here just to engage more meaningfully with her, to hear views and the bank in relation to where we are going, beyond the report itself. But I chose not to talk about it because I wanted us to proceed without having to put anybody on the back footing. Now, one of the things that in your reports is coming very clear is that our exports have declined. And you are also saying our natural destiny for exports, which is Europe, Eurozone, is going to be in a much longer, not economic crisis, but much tougher economic position. Therefore, we may need to redirect, we need to find in South Africa new destiny or markets for our own commodities. And if you look at China, which in terms of its currency, and I think you know the war currency between the U.S. and China, which has been doing rounds, China is also beginning to say, we need to move from strong exports to domestic consumption. You are saying, in our case, 2009, 2010, the sustenance of our economy was more around domestic consumption. And I think the same with most of the developing world, particularly China and India. They've got the markets, they've got domestic consumption capacity for their own products, and therefore the value of their currencies will have to respond to those challenges and realities in those countries. Now, what would be your view in our case? Given that the U.S. economy, I was just reading this morning, the Business Day, I think it's there, that in the past week and a half, almost $26 trillion U.S. dollars found their way, its way out of the main economy, real economy, the U.S., that impacts on the rest of the world. But that's not sufficient. Given the exposure of the U.S. economy to the Eurozone economy and the challenges that are there, how should we respond in South Africa to those realities? I know that National Treasury has issued a statement to say we will survive, we'll manage our way out of this. But these are the hard realities that I see from time to time as I read. And one of the key concerns that I have is that since 2007, budget deficits in the major economies or developed economies have doubled as a result of, in my view, government trying to spend their way out of the crisis. And I don't see that changing in the near future from where I'm sitting.
and how should we respond to those kind of challenges in South Africa? Because I think it is quite important for us to position ourselves in such a way that we understand this issue. Tied to that, consumer spending, belt tightening in the Eurozone itself will not necessarily stimulate demand for both local and exports from developing countries such as ourselves. How are we going to navigate that space? The other issue is the role of the banks, both here and abroad. Chinese banks are state-owned. Almost all without exception. And they do not have this kind of a crisis. And the economy is growing in that part of the world. We have had our own prudent financial management in South Africa. There's no doubt about it in terms of Basel III and so on and so forth, that we're fine. But what is your take in relation to those big economies, particularly the US and Europe, vis-a-vis the growth that you see propelled in China and the state-owned banking sector? Let me pause there. Thank you. Honorable members, any additional questions? Over to you. If you want to defer to the governor, it's fine.
Honorable Chair, thank you very much. Let me then respond. Firstly, to say that profound shifts in the international balance of power and economic power we already observe, and we are already responding to it as a nation. Actually, I've been watching, for instance, the weight of the Chinese currency, the renminbi, in our basket, which we use to calculate the effective exchange rate. Now, two revisions ago, the Chinese renminbi was not even in that basket. Now it carries a weight already of something like 12% or so. So, yes, we are exporting more and more to the exciting BRIC and other developing nations areas. And that is happening spontaneously, simply because the demand is there. And in the more mature economies, and please remember, they're not poor economies, they're quite wealthy still, but their growth prospects are clearly not as bright as those of the industrializing developing economies. And our patterns of foreign trade are already following that. So one must assume that America will muddle through and Europe will muddle through, and there will be life after all of these interruptions and volatilities, but that in the background we should be diversifying our export destinations, not shunning our traditional markets, but building on and going to some others. And in that connection, I think it's quite important that we are already seeing a redirection of our export activity and international linkages to other countries and other places, not just the traditional markets. And that should be commended and should be pursued further. I think that's quite important that we go in that direction. In terms of the financial health and the perhaps lack of setback experienced in China through their banking system because they are state-owned, yes, I think that has been a huge advantage. A country which saves so much, which saves so diligently, is in a very powerful position. I mean, they save incredible amounts, and that gave them a degree of freedom when the crisis struck to stimulate their economy and to do things to counter the recession truly powerful and truly impressive. So one must recognize that in their instance, their natural diligence in saving has been a great benefit. And for us also, to a lighter extent perhaps, by working down our government debt when we could, when the sun was shining, we also gave ourselves a little bit of extra latitude
But compared to the latitude given by such huge savings as the Chinese had, of course we don't actually compare with the magnitude which they had. I think one should, however, say that our banking sector, although not government-owned or government-dominated, did not really experience the crisis in the traditional sense. It was not exposed to those ugly asset kinds which created most of the trouble. And generally, we have had our financial system fairly supervised and within quite prudent boundaries right through this recessionary conditions and then the subsequent still fledgling upswing. So fortunately, although we have a private sector driven banking sector, our fallout from the crisis mainly came from the international weakness rather than from domestic weakness of the financial system. And I think we are proud of that and happy that banking supervisors and the financial supervisors more generally in South Africa seem to have been successful in not getting into risky ground.
Honourable members, in the absence of any questions and comments, I'll also just try to use this opportunity to ask one last question. You say our interest rates are the lowest in how many years? Since
1980.
Yes, since 1980. It's the lowest in relation to ourselves. But if you look into what other governments have done to respond to this crisis, they've almost zero-rated their interest rate. The U.S. is one of them. It's one of the biggest economies. There has been a concern about short-term capitalist inflows, and I think it's the result of, relatively speaking and comparatively speaking, our interest rates will be higher compared to others. I may be wrong, but there's also a concern that this inflow, short-term inflow, capital inflows, do have some disruptive tendencies to your own currency, either overvalued or depreciation. But in this instance, it's overvalued. This is what the argument is in the public discourse. Now, having said so, is there a possibility now with what the U.S. has done to see a redirected of capital inflows, short-term capital inflows from emerging markets to emerging economies? And what would be the implications of that to our stable currency, if one were to put it that way?
Honorable Chair, if I may respond. Of course, one should always be wary of the nominal interest rate on the one hand and the real interest rate on the other. What the Americans have, extremely low nominal interest rates, but they also have extremely low inflation. What we currently then have is a nominal interest rate, at least the repo rate of the Reserve Bank stands at 5.5%, and that's compared to inflation, which is just a little bit below that. So in real terms, our interest rates are very, very slightly positive only currently, and actually working on forward-looking inflation expectations rather than backward-looking inflation measures, you actually find that our real repo rate is perhaps also very slightly negative. So we actually have a real interest rate which is pitched to the economic circumstances, a big output gap, and generally then fair inflation prospects, which I think made it possible to bring interest rates down as far as they currently have come. That, however, lets us then be stuck with a nominal interest rate, which is still quite a bit lower than in the US, And yes, one cannot deny those international investors who are seeking nominal returns and who are willing for a time at least to take some exchange rate risk. They have appetite for then pursuing these countries where the nominal interest rates are a bit higher than in the US or in Euroland. And so we have been the recipients of that. I think what we can observe now from the current indications from the US, for instance, that they will have low interest rates for longer, is that at least that incentive to put money into emerging markets, including South Africa, will just be continued for quite a bit longer than anybody probably would have imagined 2 years ago. So it will probably continue in that way, and that will from time to time perhaps bring to our shores then more foreign capital of that more short-term interest-seeking nature. Should we be unduly concerned about that? Probably not. If we did have national savings which were huge, and we had a current account surplus accordingly, and we were exporting capital to other parts of the world, it would have been different. But we actually have a domestic savings shortfall. We actually need money from other places in the world, and that money comes in various forms. Of course, we would prefer foreign direct investment and long-term capital rather than short-term capital. But if you're in a savings shortfall situation, you actually, I think, have to just observe and be happy for the foreign money which reaches our shores and in that way ups our domestic savings or augments our domestic savings, because in the end what we really want is more investment and more growth and more employment, of course.
Thank you. I think we have honorable members come to the end of our interaction with the presentation from the South African Reserve Bank. I must say, this is very good information. As you know, in the next couple of months, if not two, this committee will be dealing with the mini-budget policy statement, which will be tabled together with the fiscal framework proposal. And this information that you have shared with us today will form the basis and the foundation of our engagement with whatever will be presented to us, so that we are able to engage more meaningfully with what National Treasury will be presenting before us, so that we can be in a better position to advise Parliament on the fiscal framework itself when it gets adopted next year, or in fact this year. And if there are any deviation in the coming financial year, it will also be informed by this kind of information that you have shared with us. And I want to really take this opportunity to thank you very much for making time and coming here well prepared to take our questions. Thank you very much. Honorable members, we are released for now until further notice. Thank you very much.